Welcome to the Business Podcast, where we interview professionals across all industries. Hey, it's Simon. Welcome back. Today we have Dr. Michelle Strahilovitz, a marketing professor and interim director for Elfinworks Center for Responsible Business at St. Mary's College and honorary research fellow at University of Wollongong. Dr. Michelle, it's great to have you here with us today. How are you doing?
It's great to be here. Very glad to be here and be part of this podcast. Thank you.
So maybe you can kick us off and tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe share something that most people would not know about you.
So I'm a behavioral economist, which means I study decision-making and both rational and not so rational behavior. I'm particularly interested in emotions and decision-making. I've been a professor and teaching for over two decades, quite a bit over two decades, but not close to three yet. And I've been teaching marketing mostly, of course, because I'm a professor of marketing. That's a big variety of courses and pretty much everything at this point, from consumer behavior to marketing strategy to marketing communications to international marketing. But very recently, which is what I'm most excited to talk about these days, I started teaching a course on happiness and well-being, basically the science of happiness and well-being. And that's what I'm most passionate about right now in terms of teaching. And because my research is on emotions and decision-making, it actually ties in with my research interests as well. So that is what I'm doing today and what I've been doing for quite a while now.
That's very interesting to hear. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you got your career start and how you decided to be doing what you're doing now. Maybe walk us through a bit of the path.
Okay. So I was working in advertising. I'm actually in an ad agency in Israel, and I was also doing marketing research. I had an MBA already, and I thought I wanted to work in the business world. That's why I got an MBA. But on the side, I started teaching English, and I really loved teaching. I was surprised by how much I loved teaching. I was teaching English to business executives, so not little kids, but I just couldn't figure out a way to make it like a full-time career. And I also started being interested more and more in why people do what they do as opposed to what works, because I was working in advertising. We wanted to know what would be effective for our clients, but I wanted to know more about, well, why does this work and this doesn't? I became very curious. So after thinking about my career goals, I thought, oh, I should become a marketing professor. Then I can understand the psychology behind consumer behavior. And also I can do what I love to do in addition to research, which is teaching. So that kind of brought me into a doctoral program. I went to Berkeley for my PhD.
You know, you talk about happiness as being something that is piquing your interest and has been piquing your interest as of recent. I'm curious what approach you take to exploring that with your background in looking at behavior and looking at economics and how both of those intertwine in commerce.
So there's kind of my research and there's my teaching. And I'd love to say that they're completely intertwined, but they're not that intertwined. So I guess I'll give a bit of an answer to both. My research has been on emotions, and I've also been interested in dysfunctional behavior. So addictive behavior, like I have a paper that's in progress that I hope to be submitting soon that looks at people who trade stocks too frequently, basically compulsive stock traders. And you might think, well, if they're trading stocks, they're probably making lots of money. But it turns out all the research way before me shows that the more you trade, the less well you do. That actually the buy and hold strategy over time is much more effective, not to mention much less stressful and time consuming. And so I was looking at who those investors are, and you might say, oh my God, this is finance. What does this have to do with happiness? So we had a surprise finding, which was that the people who trade the most frequently are also the least happy and the most miserable. So we asked questions about how often they feel sad, how often they feel angry, how often they feel worried. And they're feeling it a lot more on average the more they trade. And the ones who trade less often on average, significantly, by the way, very strong difference, are much less likely to report high scores for frequency of anger and unhappiness and sadness and depression. And then the other thing that was a huge predictor of how often they traded stocks, which again seems like investing behavior, what does it have to do with emotions, was loneliness. So being lonely, feeling like no one understands you, like no one has your back, like you often feel attacked. Those all correlated positively with frequent stock trading. So here I was looking at this, you know, impractical financial behavior, which seems to be just about investing. And it turns out that emotions and unhappiness or lack of happiness are actually driving it. They also reported being happy less often and more anxious, right? So something that I thought was going to be about, well, maybe they just don't know they shouldn't be trading frequently. If we just tell them, oh, the more you trade on average, the less you'll perform, then they'll stop doing it. But if the reason they're doing it is because they're lonely, sad, don't feel supported, et cetera, then we have to do more for them to get them to behave more rationally than just tell them this is irrational. We actually have to make them happier and get them some social support. And that actually maps onto the research on addiction. Alcoholism isn't about not understanding that too much alcohol is bad. It's often about dealing with negative emotions, and you drink to escape, and that's true for drugs. That's true for a lot of disordered behavior. Compulsive shopping is often an escape from what's going on in your life. So that's where my research is kind of tied into it. There are some other areas, like I look at cause marketing, which is when brands link their products or the sale of their products to supporting a worthy cause. And my research has actually shown, this was my dissertation, that if you're selling products that make people happy, but maybe feel guilty as well, like chocolate or luxury vacations, then linking to charity will do more for your brand than if it's a product that people don't have much emotion with one way or the other, like toilet paper, although this was pre-pandemic. After the pandemic, toilet paper became very exciting. But, you know, the things you need, like dishwashing soap and, you know, gas for your car, that's not a fun thing. That's a thing you need for the function that it provides for you. But if something is consumed for the sheer happiness of it, and sometimes you feel guilty, those things benefit the most from a donation to charity. And the reason for that is there's tons of research before my dissertation showing that the happier you are, the more likely you are to give to charity, but also the more you feel guilty, the more you are likely to give to charity. So these products that make us happy, but maybe a little bit guilty, or, you know, sort of the guilt of overindulging, those ones are the categories where cause marketing is particularly effective. So that was, again, about sort of happiness and how it drives donations to charity. But in the teaching front, I became interested in this topic in part because when the lockdown started, I had all these students who had been very happy and basically, you know, not suffering from anxiety, writing me that this is really hard for them. I had a class, well, pretty much every professor had a class that in the middle of the semester, I had multiple classes actually, that in the middle of the semester, we went from in-person face-to-face and a pretty normal life, no masks, to everyone's at home, locked down, can barely leave the house, have to wear a mask all the time. And people started to feel really isolated. And that included my students who had shared previously that they were dealing with anxiety or depression or both, or some sort of emotional or social anxiety, and also the ones who were doing real well before. And I just thought, wow, my students need some help with this. And to be honest, I wasn't really enjoying staring at a computer for all my social interactions either. And I missed going to the gym and going to movies and interacting with everyone and not, you know, not thinking twice about going out to a restaurant with a bunch of friends. So I was struggling too. And that's when I started delving not just into my own research, but research that other people have done, which is what I bring into the classroom often. What have other people learned will help people be happier? And there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, it's a long, intensive course, but some of the things are really simple. So what's kind of exciting is the things that are the most effective, both for the students I've taught, and I've now taught it multiple times. I guess I've taught it twice and I'm about to teach it three more times. Yes, I taught it twice and I'm about to teach three sections simultaneously. And we had the longest wait list we've ever had for a course to be taught in January. I have a wait list that's three times bigger than the actual size of the class, but they wouldn't let me keep teaching more and more sections. But now that I've been teaching it for a while, the things that have worked the best with my students and with other professors who've taught this similarly, and according to researchers who've been studying it, are these very simple things, like just making a commitment every day to do something that's fun and good for you, right? Some sort of self-care thing that's not, it doesn't have to be super fun, but not something you hate doing. So it feeds your happiness, but it's also good for you, not just in the short term when you're doing it, but also in the long term. So that could be taking a walk, that could be talking to a friend on the phone, something that has benefits in the moment, but also in the long term. And that's not super, you might go, well, Michelle, that's like obvious. Of course, things that make you happy, but it's making a commitment to do it every day that increases the chance you will do it. So when I make my students write on Facebook, this is what I'm going to be doing today, and they have to do it in a little group, even though I'm not crazy about Facebook, but that's the tool we ended up using. You could use any other tool if you're, you know, against Facebook right now, which is understandable. But I have them log in and say, you know, publicly, hey, I'm going to be going for a walk, or I'm going to make some time for art, or I'm going to meditate, or I'm going to do yoga, or I'm going to, you know, interact with, I'm going to go for a walk outside with my friends, or I'm just going to spend some time in nature, I'm going to do some gardening, whatever it was that they know makes them happy in the short term, but is also good for them. They committed, and then they did it, and they were so much happier, because when they did commit, and they had to be accountable to the class and say whether they did it or not, their compliance went up hugely. And most of these kids were not doing this stuff every day. And I told them, if there's something you do every day already, don't commit that. That doesn't count. You're not getting anything added bonus. Come up with something new. So if you walk every morning anyway, come up with something else you can do during the day for yourself. And it just can't be something that's fun and bad for you. So getting drunk might be fun if you're an undergrad in college, but we all know that's not a good thing, and you're not going to be super happy later with how it makes you feel. So they all had to add something to any routine they already have. And students were just, you'd think I'd invented some magic potion. They were like, God, I'm so much happier. And then the other thing, which nobody thought would have an effect, hardly, was they were like, oh, that's silly. They had to list three things they were grateful for every day. These are just two of them. I had like 20 things. But these are easy for all of us, right? Three things you're grateful for every day, and you could either share it with someone or write it in a journal. But just listing three things and making sure at least one of those things isn't huge. So sometimes you might go, well, I don't have anything to be grateful for. It's a terrible day. Well, you can be grateful that there are pretty trees outside, or that it's not raining, or that it is raining, because in California, we don't get enough rain, so we're grateful either way. Or whatever it is, you can be grateful for a good lunch. You can be grateful for a good friend. You can be grateful that your parents are alive, or that someone you love is alive. You can be grateful for pets. You can be grateful for a potted orchid that you have. It can be small things, but just focusing on those things that give you pleasure and happiness, even if it's not enormous, it makes you happier. If you don't pay attention to the good things in your life, you're going to be miserable. And everyone has bad things in their life. Even the people we envy, if you dig and get to know them well, you'll find out these super successful, amazing people also have internal struggles. But if all they do all day is focus on what they're miserable about, they're just going to be more miserable. If you give attention to the things in your life that you can be grateful for, even if they're small, it makes you happier. So unfortunately, that's not something I invented with my research. People have been talking about that literally for decades. I think academia was slow to research it, to be honest. I remember books from the 70s that talked about doing this. But the really great thing back when I was like just born in the 70s. But anyway, but they were old books. So the point is that this thing that's so small, just listing three things you're grateful for every day that you remember to do it, maybe sharing it with a friend, which makes it more powerful, or writing it down, really makes people happier. And again, this was something that my students in the class said was something that they were going to keep. And in fact, I had them commit at the end of the semester, what are two things that had the biggest effect on you that you learned from this class? And tell me why you're committed to keeping them. And these were the two things that were top of the list. Some other students had other things, it varied. But this was something I would say the majority of students had one of those two things or both out of 20 things that they said, this had a huge impact on me and I want to keep doing it even after the class is over. And some of them I know are still doing it because they're still posting it on our group every day, which is awesome for me because I really enjoy reading. I mean, generally grading homework is the thing professors hate the most, but reading gratitude lists and how my students are taking care of themselves and how happy it's made them, that's fun. So that's been a really great experience for me. It's the funnest grading I've ever had, for sure. And the funnest results, because students generally, I mean, I'm a successful teacher in general students, not everybody, but general students like my class. But this is a class that I'm hoping will give them tools to make them happier for the rest of their lives. I can't say that about every subject I teach. And so it's super rewarding when students just say, this class really changed my life. I'm feeling so much better, even a month or two after. And I had one student who actually wrote me about 6 weeks after the class saying, I feel like this course changed my life. And that's a big deal. I don't get that very often. You say, marketing research really changed my life. I'm much happier. That hasn't happened to me. So it's been pretty awesome to have that experience as a teacher.
That's wonderful to hear in academia, to hear that from a student. I'm sure it's extremely rewarding for you.
Very, very.
I wonder what your thoughts are around the effect of participating in these happiness exercises as a group and the impact that has on the students in comparison to them continuing it after the class is over. What have you noticed there in terms of impact?
Look, it's a lot easier when there's a class and there's homework and you're accountable and I'm checking and I'm emailing people who didn't post and saying, hey, you didn't post. I'm going to let you turn it in late, but go ahead and post something. Please post. A, they feel cared about. Some of them may have felt harassed too, but they also felt cared about. Like I was, ah, I want you to be happy. Do your freaking happiness homework. As opposed to do your statistics, which is nowhere near as fun. But I think there was something about listening to each other that they got a lot out of. So it wasn't all me. I can't take all the credit for the course. They actually got a lot out of each other. And in fact, the students who shared the most, I think got the most out of it, but they also gave the most to other students. The students who shared the most were very much appreciated because they had the courage to say, you know, sometimes I struggle with this and this and this, and by focusing on this, I was able to deal with it. Or I'm going through this really hard period right now. One of them was injured. One of them was dealing with loss of a friend who had passed. And they're sharing that and just saying, but, you know, I still need to be grateful. And I just know, for example, the guy said that I know my friends would not want me to be depressed. They'd want me to enjoy the life that I have and realize what a gift it is. And, you know, each of the students sharing gave inspiration to other students. And then they supported each other. They said, bro, you were really brave. Or, oh, thanks for sharing that. Or, oh, I can so relate to what you shared. I totally have the same experience. And I think that camaraderie goes back to my research finding with the frequent traders, right? It's not just sadness, it's loneliness. And those two things aren't two separate things. So that sense of community also makes you happier, right? Even if you're in a great community and you're studying plants or how to make, you know, whatever it is you want to make, how to make Thai food or whatever it is, community increases happiness. And it also increases accountability to do the things that make us happier. So it's pretty awesome. And I think that class, even though it was fully online, because, you know, we had the COVID limitations, I think that's one of the most bonded classes I've ever taught. And I'm sure it would have been even more bonded in person, but we didn't have that option when I taught it. But even online, they really connected. They made lifelong friends. Some of them had been in classes together before and didn't get to know each other until the class. In that, you know, they shared a class with somebody else, but we were talking about international marketing concepts. And that's not as personal. You don't share as much about yourself as when you're talking about happiness and stress and things you're grateful for and things you're proud of and sort of, you know, think of a negative and look at the silver lining of it. It was really, I think, just we all became much closer. I think I got closer to my students than I normally do, and the students got closer to each other, and that community facilitated happiness. If I just gave them a workbook with all the homework, I still think it would have an effect, but nowhere near as powerful. And I think this is one of the few classes where I had at least as many students sad it was the last day as relieved. And it was a class that met 4 days a week. So you can imagine we were all kind of exhausted, but a lot of students were like, I'm really sad the class is over. And that's not normal. That's not normal undergraduate talk. And I was pretty sad about it too, although I was happy not to be teaching as many hours a week, but I missed that group and that class and that topic and the reward that came with teaching something so impactful.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really inspiring to hear, actually. And, you know, the impact that one class can have on someone is important. And the fact that you take it from a marketing perspective and you translate it to business and let them see that, you know, maybe it's about pursuing the things that they value most,
right?
And getting good at it. And it might be circumstances where the thing that they think is most worth pursuing right now, when they actually get into the motions, they find out they're not really into it, but at least they strove for it and they took action.
Right.
It's about that lived experience that real world application that takes you out of theory, takes you out of the textbook. Mm-hmm. And it seems that positive feedback that they're getting from actually taking the action is what's also playing a big factor in influencing their overall impression of the teachings and the courses. I'm curious.
Yeah, the one more thing I'll add is, you know, I had like lots and lots of things that research had showed makes you happier that I had them try. And some of them were huge on me, you know, big impact on me. And some of them were just tons of research shows that it has an effect. And it didn't work for all of them. So out of the 20 things or so, I mean, I'm not sure it was exactly 20 that we did, some of them got a lot out of some. They all got something substantial out of at least a few of the exercises, but some of them, they had exercises where they're like, yeah, it didn't really have a big effect on me. And so what I told them is, you know, there's research about what works for the majority of people the majority of the time, but what you care most about in your own life is what works for me, right? So for example, you may love public speaking. Someone else might love crunching numbers. That doesn't mean you're wrong that you don't love crunching numbers or that they're wrong because they don't like public speaking. It's we're different. And you want to hack your own happiness. So what I told them is I want you to pay attention. When you try something and it doesn't work, that's information. That's how we learn, right? That's how we, oh, this doesn't, clearly this strategy isn't working for me. So this is not something I will continue doing. And I try to carry that over because, you know, they're young. This was an undergraduate class. They're young in their careers. Some of them haven't even really started yet. And they have to know that, you know, you might pursue a career and realize, God, I hate this. This was what I always thought I wanted to do, but I don't enjoy this at all. And that doesn't mean you wasted your time. You learn something about yourself and you take that information and you apply it into the next thing. I always told them their first job is not a contract for the next 50 years. We live at a time where people move on and change careers and change companies and change roles all the time. So if you try something, whatever it is, a job, a major, a strategy for being happier, an exercise, you know, maybe you take a gym class and you hate it, but then you try another thing and you like it. That's not a waste of time because you didn't get something out of it or it didn't work. That's how you learn. And I have a great story, at least I think it's a great story, about when I was about 18, I was visiting my aunt who recently passed away. I adored her. Her name was Shoshana. And I was visiting her actually in Israel, and she was watching, this is ages ago, right? But she was watching the Olympics, and it was, I don't even remember what year it was, but she was watching the Olympics and she said, you should watch this interview with this skater. I saw it earlier and they're airing it again. She's really amazing. She wasn't Israeli, but we happened to be in Israel. I think it was an American skater, in fact. But she was an ice skater and she'd won some kind of, I don't think she'd won the gold, it was the silver or the bronze, but they were interviewing her and they were asking her all these questions. And then she said, he said, oh, I know you said you brought some video clips of yourself skating at different stages in your career, even when you were a little girl, the ones you're most proud of that you think made you a great skater. Are you willing to share those? And she said, of course, that's what they're here for. She was very funny. And so she showed the video, and every single video she fell down. Every single one, she fell down and got up, and she wasn't graceful falling down in any of them. I mean, this wasn't like she did a super duper triple black flip amazing thing and then fell. She was just kind of, these were not, I mean, this was not, this was not a 10, a 9, or an 8, right? And in every single one she fell, but in every single one she got up. And he said, but these can't be your best moments. You were an amazing skater. You have a medal from the Olympics. You're, you know, ranked number 2 in the world. Like, why in the world did you show these video clips? And she said, a great skater isn't someone who's always perfect. A great skater is someone who always gets up when they fall. And I was 18, so more than 5 years ago. I remember that stuck. I mean, I've been teaching as a professor for 20 years, and that was before I was even done with undergrad. So you can imagine that was a long time ago. But it stuck with me, and I'm very grateful for my aunt for saying, watch this, because it's true. People are not successful because everything they do is perfect. I'm sorry, there's a cat meowing who's very needy right now, so that's why you're hearing background noise. But he is my cat, so I'm gonna have to take care of him right now. Simultaneously I'm talking. But what makes you great is not that everything you try comes out perfectly, or that everything you try, you're good at it the first time you try it. Nobody is a Olympic contender because the first time they put on skates, they were graceful and amazing. Great skaters fall all the time. They just get up. And I'm not an ice skater. I never learned how to ice skate. It's not about that. It's about wanting something, caring about it, committing to it, trying, failing, and getting up. And if you're not willing to get up when you fall, you're not going to go very far, and you're not going to be in the Olympics. or anything, and forget athletics. That's true for whatever it is that you want to pursue and be great at. You won't be great every time, and you certainly won't be as good at the beginning as you will be if you keep practicing and learning. And they really liked that story because a lot of them, you know, they get an interview and they don't get the job and they're like, I'm a loser. I'll never succeed. I give up. I'm never going to get a job in whatever it is, right? And it's like, no, you just had an ice skating experience. Are you going to get up? Or are you going to stay on the ice and cry for the rest of your life? Like, are you really going to give up because you tried for something and you didn't get it? There's also a story about Sylvester Stallone. You may have heard of the film Rocky. I think it was darn successful with a lot of sequels. But he shopped that around and studios were not interested. And then a studio agreed, but offered him money only on the contingency that he could not star in it because they didn't think he was right for the role. They wanted a big name. And he said, no, if I'm not in it, I won't let you have it. And they're like, yeah, we don't want you in it. We can get a real name. And you're not going to be a good actor. No one wants your voice. It's not going to work. You're not an actor. This is a good play. We're going to give you some money. He was broke. He had sold his dog because he couldn't afford to feed him. I mean, he was completely broke. And he said, no, if I'm not going to be in it, I'm not willing to do it. At the last minute, they caved. They said, okay, we're only going to pay you like way less than we offered you before, and we'll let you be in it. But it's going to be low budget. It's not going to succeed. But we'll tell you what, if you're not willing to agree not to be in it, we'll let you in it, but we're going to pay you a lot less. And he said, yes. And that movie was Rocky I. And I believe it was a big hit. And then there was Rocky II, III, IV. I don't know how many Rockies there have been. But nobody's been saying, you know, Sylvester Stallone, we don't want you in the Rocky sequels. No one said, we have someone better for the role. And he basically fell down a lot, but he was super committed. I want to be in this movie that I've written a screenplay for, and I can't do a Rocky accent. I can't do Sylvester Stallone, and I'm not giving up. And that's why there was Rocky 1, 2, 3, and 4. If he fell down on this and never got up, there would be no Rocky. There would be no Rocky sequel. And so those little stories that students hear can apply to their business life and can apply to their romantic life and can apply to their health, you know, how fit you are, how well you take care of yourself, can apply to everything. We're all going to fall down, and we need to remember successful people fall down too. They just get up. And I'm a little obsessed with that storyline. So sorry for telling it kind of twice with two different characters.
Thank you. After speaking to a number of people, it's evident that in your voice, just the quality of how you express yourself, you're a happy person. So the question comes, what makes you happy?
Oh, lots of things make me happy. And I will be honest, I'm not always happy. I'm generally happy, it's true. I certainly am happier probably than most people most of the time, but I definitely have times where I'm not happy. So there's a lot of things that make me happy. Exercise, I'm one of those people that if I'm not physically active, I'm quite miserable. Exercise makes me happy. That's true for a whole lot of people, by the way. The outdoors makes me happy. Getting some fresh air, being near nature, being near trees, when they're not being extremely naughty and meowing during a podcast. My two cats make me happy. They were COVID foster kittens. I was like, lockdown, I need kittens. I'll just foster them. This isn't the kind of cat I want. They're very fluffy and I wanted short haired, but yeah, they make me very happy most of the time. Friends make me happy. Family makes me happy. None of them always make me happy. Giving, being appreciated, being creative makes me happy. Quite a few things make me unhappy, and I try to do the ones I have to do that make me unhappy, but I'm learning rather late in life to say no to things that I don't really have to do that also don't make me happy and aren't really important, but somehow I got dragged into them. But yeah, those things, and by the way, I'm not unusual. Health and fresh air and exercise and hanging out with people who love you and pets that love you, those things make me happy, but tons of research shows that's actually going to make most people happier. So those are things that are a big part of my life.
That's great.
And also orchids. My orchids make me happy.
That's good. That's good. And as you were speaking earlier and telling your stories, the idea came to mind as to whether are there any particular activities that help to shift mindset or develop the kind of mindset or attitude, if you will, that is striving to go for the result? Because in those stories you shared, the common thread is, if I were to summarize it, you know, being so determined to win that you're okay with failing along the way. So I wonder if you've picked up on any specific activities or habits that help to change mindset for people, because that can probably have a big impact.
Stories like those. I mean, honestly, there's a couple stories. Like, also the founder of Spanx has this crazy story where she was, stories can help a lot. So the founder of Spanx, by the way, has a great story. I'm worried I'm taking too much time with these stories, but if people Google it, like, she's amazing. Super, super energetic and had a really big struggle in her career and in her, you know, finding her professional goal. And I don't wear Spanx. I'm not a fan of that category, but I'm a huge fan of hers because she's, you know, self-made billionaire. My God. And she didn't do it because she had $20 million, like some former presidents who were elected only in 2016. Oops. That's okay. Who sort of, you know, got $1 million from mommy and daddy and had a lot of doors opened. That wasn't her story. She wasn't dirt poor, but she also had lots of failure along the way. And stories like hers, and certainly the ice skater I told, and no question Sylvester Stallone, are actually really helpful. So if I'm trying something and I get a rejection, I just remember, well, Sylvester Stallone was rejected. And the theme song from Rocky is actually a song that a lot of people play. Dun-dun, 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 right? They actually play it because that is kind of the Rocky story too, oddly enough. They play that song and I'll actually think of that song in my head when like I get a rejection for a grant and I'm like, oh, I suck at getting grants. And then I'm like, dun-dun, dun-dun. And I just remember, well, Sylvester couldn't get Rocky made. Or I just remember the ice skater who's on the ground and she decides she's going to get up again and again and again until she's a great ice skater. And that works for me. And I think it works for the students too, just to realize, you know, something, this word failure, it applies to the people, not the ones who fall, the ones who don't get up. You are a failure. If you try to skate, you fall and then you throw the skates out and you get off the ice and you say, I'm never getting on the ice again. You have failed at ice skating. At that point, you're never going to get on the ice skate again. I mean, which is fine because personally, I don't even ice skate. But if you decide I don't want to ice skate, that's fine. But at this point, you're definitely not going to be an ice skater. You kind of gave up, right? And that is a kind of failure, though it's certainly not a kind of failure if you decide you don't even like it. You don't want to be an ice skate anyway. But you know, I have them redefine failure. Failure is giving up, even though you still want to do it. That's failure. Making a mistake, trying for something and not getting it. That's Rocky. That's the story of Sylvester Stallone, who's doing okay. I think he's got a pretty big career. he's still respected. He's still admired. He's still relevant. People still care about what he's writing. And people, you know, if there's a movie with him, people will show up. And so he's a great role model. And do I want to be Rocky? No, I'm nothing like Sylvester Stallone, really. Except I really, really, I mean, I think he's smart and talented, but I don't want to be Rocky. I want to be like Sylvester Stallone in that he just had that vision. And I think once students realize, you know, the fact that I'm giving up, that's what's going to make me a failure. If I want it badly enough, I should keep trying. That in itself changes their feeling, because that way every time they apply for a job and don't get it, instead of saying I'm such a loser, I'm such a failure, I have them say, well, I learned from that. What did I learn from this? What can I do to make the best of it? What's the silver lining? And they're also, we have them answer, it wasn't their favorite, but it scored pretty high. What are some empowering questions for when, you know, bad things happen? So if you have something disappointing or upsetting happen or that hurts your feelings, what's a question you can ask yourself that'll make you happier? Here's one that doesn't work. Why do bad things always happen to me? Why am I such a loser? Those questions make you feel worse. So if those are your questions, stop it. Throw the questions away. Those are dumb questions. They're just going to make you feel worse. And instead, you ask questions like, well, what can I do to make the best of this? Or what can I learn from this? Or is there anything I can do to make this less bad? And if you start asking questions like that, you realize it's just like tennis. You know, the balls come at you and you try to hit them and, you know, try to hit them properly. I'm not a tennis player either, so I'm probably going to mess up the terminology. But if you miss a tennis ball, you don't say, okay, I'm not playing anymore. I quit. And walk away from the game. No, you're just sort of like, oh yeah, I should have stretched a little differently, or oh, I should have been paying more attention, or whatever. Maybe I just couldn't get that ball. And then you try to hit the next ball, and when they realize that they sort of get those metaphors, I think it puts them in a different mindset. And they're also looking always for what can I do to make this better? Or what can I do, learn from this? Instead of why am I such a loser? And how come horrible things always happen to me? And why do I suck so much? Those are terrible questions. And they're very common questions that I will admit that in my lifetime, there was a period where I asked myself questions like that. And it did not make me happy. It just made something bad worse than it had to be. And sure, these questions don't make you happy every time something terrible happens, but they make you less miserable. And being less miserable sometimes is going to be the best you can do. And so you do that. Obviously, if you lose a loved one, you're not going to be happy. You're going to be sad. And being sad is normal and healthy. And you know, nobody's never sad. That's denial. That's not good either. But you can try to make the best of sad situations and do something that will help you get through it. And I had, you know, many years ago, I lost someone very surprisingly. He was even younger than me. He was a friend, wasn't a family member. But he was hit by a car and killed as he was crossing the road. It was not expected at all. It was the middle of the day. He was crossing on a green light. Black SUV sped by, hit him. He died immediately. I was supposed to see him the next day. I was on my way to visit him. I got the call like in the evening before I was supposed to fly to see him. And I was a mess. I mean, this was many years ago, but I was a complete mess. I was constantly crying. I was not okay. I was just too shocked. It wasn't something I was remotely in my realm of possibility. It's not like losing your great-great-grandmother who was 97 and it's awful, but you kind of knew it was coming. And at some point I just had to ask myself, would he want me to be this miserable this long? And I thought, no, he would be thinking, what are you doing? You're alive. Make the best of it. I'm not alive. I wouldn't do what you're doing. I wouldn't cry. It's great that you're sad. You liked me a lot. I get it. You even loved me. You thought I was wonderful. You wish I was alive. You're really pissed that I'm dead. Move on, Michelle. And somehow that empowered me, right? To say, well, it's not like I'm not going to always be sad that he died or ever think that that was anything but horrible and unfair. But I can think he would not want me lying in bed crying all the time. He'd want me to go take a walk on the beach and, you know, dance and do all the things that we both like doing. So sometimes it doesn't make you happy, but sort of reframing how to deal with something difficult can make you less miserable. And sometimes that's the best you can do. Something terrible happens. You're not going to be thrilled with it, but you can get yourself out of that despair spiral a lot quicker. And that's always going to help to just make yourself accept that you're sad, but not let it become your new constant state for the rest of your life. Long answer, huh?
I'm enjoying the conversation. I wonder what kind of interesting, funny stories have come about along your career that come to mind, whether it relates to happiness, which is more of something recent, or along some research studies that you've done in the past or courses that you've taught.
Funny. Oh my God, funny. Funny stuff happens all the time, but now I'm not remembering. This is sad because funny stuff happens with me all the time. I guess I can tell a story that's not about happiness. I was actually teaching advertising at University of Miami, which is close to you because I know you're also a Miami guy. So back in Dade County, years ago, I was very enthusiastic about teaching. And I use my hands, so it's not as clear when we're in a podcast, but when I'm teaching, I use my hands a lot if it's in person, not as much on Zoom, but in person, I'm walking around the room and my hands are all over the place, not in a crazy way, but I'm just someone, they used to say, keep your hands still when you're presenting. That used to be all the advice in all the presentation classes. And I just said, I can't do it. So if I keep my hands still, I'm just not gonna be able to focus on what I'm doing because I'll be trying so hard to remember to keep my hands still. So I just can't do it. And then recently all the research shows, no, you should move your hands. So all these people are like practicing moving their hands, which to me is like practicing breathing. It's like, practicing moving your hands? So I move my hands all over the place, right? And that's just natural for me. It's the way I process in the world. I'm running around and moving my hands while I teach. And I was super excited and I hit my nose with my hand really hard. And then I go, ow, wow, I think I really hurt my nose. And then I kept teaching. And then one of the students raises his hand and goes, Michelle, you're bleeding. And I go, where? And he goes, out of your nose. You gave yourself, I think you gave yourself a bloody nose. And I'm just like, oh, and I go, well, there's only 10 minutes left. I don't have time to deal with this. So I grab some Kleenex and I'm just holding my nose so it won't bleed. And they go, do you need to go to the bathroom? And I go, no, I want to get through this material. It's really important. I want to show another ad. It's an example of something. And so I was holding my nose so it wouldn't bleed. And so I was talking with my nose plugged up and I was like, so this ad, so this ad, as you can see this ad, and everyone's laughing and I go, I know I sound funny, but we need to get through this before the end of class. It's a really good commercial and it fits with what we've been discussing. And I was basically holding my nose and sounding very strange while teaching and the students were laughing hysterically. And I think there was some blood involved too. It was quite a mess. And I got through the class and I ended, you know, on time, got through the material, went to the bathroom and thought, oh my God, I've been bleeding. I've got a bloody Kleenex that I'm holding. The students are like, what do we do if she bleeds to death while she's in the middle of teaching us a concept? But I think after that, I told them, I think I've proven that I'm dedicated to teaching. Unfortunately, I didn't bleed to death and the nosebleed stopped. It wasn't severe. I didn't break my nose or anything, but I think that was a funny moment in my teaching career. Quite a few years ago now.
Bizarre. I'm with you. So you're saying all this and I'm thinking, okay, are there any YouTube videos of you giving lectures? Because it seems like
you're... Oh, there are lots of them, but not with a bloody nose, no. So not with a bloody nose or holding my nose. But there are some YouTube. So I've got a couple things that are pretty old, but I very recently, in June of this year, in fact, it was June 15th of 2021, I actually chaired a panel on this very topic, happiness. I can send you a link if you want to add it to the podcast. But I had a bunch of
totally
teach and or do research on happiness, either one of them or both of them. And it was actually me and four other professors. Had someone from UT Austin. I had someone from University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. Another University of Michigan. I'm trying to remember which University of Michigan it was. Oh God, I'm there. Oh no, my mother. Okay, I'm gonna let that go. Are you still there? Uh-oh.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry, the phone rang. I did tell her I'd be busy till 6, but but she calls me all the time. She's okay. So let's see, University of Michigan, UT Austin, and Yale. Two people from University of Michigan at Dearborn and University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, UT Austin and Yale, four professors, Zoe, Raj, Ethan, and Aaron, and me talking about research and teaching on happiness and well-being for an hour and a half. And it was awesome. I loved it. I think everyone really enjoyed it on the panel. It was for a conference. And yeah, I can send you that. And that's a recent one. And the bonus there is you get to hear me, but then you get to hear these other for researchers, teachers who are awesome as well, or I shouldn't say as well, that sounds like I just said I was awesome, but I think we were a great group and we had, you know, good energy. We all enjoyed listening to each other and learning from each other and sharing our own insights. And that's something that's a recent video. I've got some other videos that aren't too old, but that one might be the most relevant for this particular conversation you and I are having right now. And you get
wonderful
a bonus because it's not just me.
Bonus, I'm a fan. I'm definitely a fan. Michelle, it's been fun speaking to you for sure and hearing about your research, your teaching, your experiences, and getting a sense of your personality. If we switched it up a little bit and you could go back in time and meet anyone in history, who comes to mind?
It's funny. I teach at a Catholic school and I'm Jewish and I'm definitely still Jewish even after 2+ years at a Catholic school. But I think I would pick Mother Teresa. I would just love to get to know her. I'm obviously a big fan of Mother Teresa. You don't have to be Catholic to love Mother Teresa. She would be high on my list. She just gave so much. And by the way, doing things for others also makes you happier. I do not claim to compete or want to be on the level of Mother Teresa. But yeah, I think she would just be so fascinating because I would like to know if she did self-care. You know, she was so good on giving. On giving, she got a better score than anyone I can think of in history, or at least it doesn't get any better than that. But I'd always wonder, like, did you also, you know, eat ice cream and dance to music? And did you ever just do stuff for you? I've always been curious because she just had so much to give. And the research shows if you don't give to yourself, you'll run out of gas. This is a big problem for parents of babies, right? I mean, they always say moms, but it can be dads as well. If they're giving and giving to their kids and they don't practice self-care, they don't have as much to give eventually. It's also true if you just give and give to yourself and you don't give to anyone else, you won't have the same depth of happiness if it's all about you and eating ice cream and going dancing and buying yourself new shoes. That doesn't lead to deep happiness. Giving to others does. But I'm always fascinated by the people who seem to be scoring really high on one happiness dimension, giving to others. So that's why I thought of her, and are not, don't appear to be doing the other. And I sort of wonder, did she ever think about like going to Hawaii and just kind of chilling for 3 weeks and staying at a nice place? Or was she always 100% able to just say, nope, too much self, you know, it's all about the others. And I would love to have taken her to Hawaii to a spa. Or some, not that I've gone to a spa in Hawaii in the last decade, but I certainly would like to. But I would love, I've been to Hawaii. You know, I would like to take her on a nice vacation if I could, and just kind of let her spoil herself and not just care for others. Though I would want her to go back to being her wonderful, regular, saintly, wonderful human being. But I think I would have liked to have just spoiled her a little, because she seemed so much other focused. And I find her both an inspiration and, you know, what could I do for Mother Teresa? I could take her to a nice restaurant and have her get a massage or something. I don't know. That's silly. But she's someone that many of us admire. And I would personally like to spoil her a little if she was still alive and available for a day.
Totally. Well, it's fun hearing your ideas, and certainly looking forward to speaking again. But until then, maybe you can share a parting thought.
Parting thought. You know, all of us, even me, who's generally happy, need to make time for the things that are healthy for us and make us happier. We also need to make time for others and doing things for others, because that also long-term will make you happier. And if you have too much on your plate, take some things off your plate. Unless your house is literally on fire and you really need to focus on getting you and your loved ones and your pets out of the house, you don't have an excuse for not making time for some self-care on a very regular basis. Oh, and the other thing is get an accountability buddy. Oh my God, it's another story. But I ended up with an accountability buddy from an online class where I posted, I'm looking for a happiness accountability buddy. A bunch of people responded who lived in the Bay Area. They have PhDs. They were about my age. We had so much in common. And they all were kind of, they weren't really committed. They weren't sharing much. They kept sharing the same gratitude list every day. Then they disappeared. And one person responded, and I thought, I have nothing in common with her. She was literally half my age, lives in London, and works in fashion. And I am a comfort freak. So I'm not a fashion person. And I'm, you know, older than her, and she's in England. And I'm thinking, what did I have in common with her? She's ended up being a wonderful friend. And this is a nice little story. We started last year, November. We're going to have our 1 year accountability buddy for happiness. And we share on a daily basis what we're grateful for, what we're doing to take care of ourselves, and anything else we want to share. We do it pretty much at least 6 days a week. So I would say another piece of advice is if you're having problems sticking to self-care or gratitude list or whatever it is, get an accountability buddy. And they don't even have to be someone you've met. I've never met her. She lives in London. I live near, you know, in the Bay Area of California. They don't have to be the same age or the same profession or the same much of anything. She's delightful. We've gotten to be quite good friends. And I kind of found her randomly. And I never would have guessed she would work out for 11 months and counting, but she did. So I would say a departing thought is if you struggle with these things, find someone else, someone, you know, you feel comfortable with, and share on a daily basis with each other. Make a commitment every day to each other. And if you fall off the wagon and don't do it for a day or two, get back on the wagon, just like everything else. Messing up is only really messing up if you stay on the floor of the ice rink and refuse to get back up. Put on your skates or leave your skates on, get up and skate. So that's my parting words, I guess.
Fantastic. Talk soon. Thank you so much, Michelle.
You're a great interviewer, by the way. Best interviewer I've had yet. So you were fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks for attending the Business Podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes.